Okay, and welcome to Grok the Talk. And tonight we are going into Planetary Tantra Talk number 7, which is tentatively titled March 19th and the events therein, and where Planetary Tantra goes fractal. Now, it's been a couple weeks since John and I have talked verbally, and so there are many things to discuss tonight, and most of that will be focusing on the events of March 19th and what they mean to the divine experiment. Let's see. I want to get the date out here. It is June the 12th. We're just about 2 days outside of a full moon, and we are in the middle of quite a heavy surge right now, which is something we might talk about a bit as well. We are in the shift of Bhagalamukhi, which will lead us into the first question I want to run by John tonight. So, John, I welcome you to Planetary Tantra Talk number 7, and how are things in Belgium?
Pretty fine. The world is still holding together here in the rotten heart of Europe.
And you're all settled in, huh?
Yes, I'm comfortable. Thank you.
Fantastic. All right, well, let's go ahead and dive into things as we usually do. I want to say a couple things here at the beginning. One was when we did our first Planetary Tantra talk, you had mentioned that Carlos Castaneda was, in a sense, the run-up to Planetary Tantra. And I remember thinking at the time that that's quite a huge statement to make, but I just kind of let it sit in my mind there for the first few weeks. And what has happened for myself personally over these 6 months of working with the Shakti cluster, taking the Gayan Tantra vow, working with these concepts on a daily basis, is that everything I've tested out has proven to be very provable in that sense. In other words, there are direct outcomes of the testing of these ideas and practices. So I believe that what you were saying there with Carlos Castaneda being a run-up to Planetary Tantra was spot on. And if anything, it's an understatement. I just want to say that this is really it. This is what I've been looking for, you know, for decades. And I think there are a lot of people out there who are also coming into that that understanding. Now, John, is there anything you would like to say about that?
Sure. There's a consistent phenomenon that happens with Planetary Tantra. When people encounter this material, they have an immediate recognition. It doesn't take a while to get into it. It doesn't require study. It doesn't require going through a progressive process. It's something that hits you immediately, if it hits you at all. And what I'm finding is that those people who contact me and express that recognition often refer to Castaneda in this same manner. In fact, just 20 minutes ago, I got an email from someone living here in Spain who said that she attended one of the last talks that Castaneda gave, in which he spoke of Christianity and the image of the crucifixion in exactly the same way that I do on metahistory.org. I have said, for instance, in this, on the site and in my book, that the image of the crucifixion of a tortured man on a cross actually crucifies our powers of imagination and fixes us in a lethal spell where suffering assumes an inordinate value. Power of suffering appears to be more powerful than the life force itself. Therefore, this image of the crucifixion, which is an archontic deception imposed on humanity, is a terrible blow to the human spirit and a terrible deviance in the divine experiment. I've said this many times, and according to this woman who heard Castaneda speak, he said exactly the same thing. Also, he warned about the arc of the flyers and these inorganic beings who prey on us, in the same manner in which I warned about the archons following the textual material of the Gnostic writings. So, yeah, I know. I thought it was pretty outrageous myself, like, when I said that Castaneda was the warm-up act for Planetary Tantra. But it's not just a claim. It's something that you may recognize when you are hit by the true power of this practice.
Yes, indeed. It really does. It's kind of hard for myself to come to grips with the fact that I'm right in the middle of this right now. It's something I hadn't even dreamed about, you know, say 7 months ago or 8 months ago. And to be in the midst of it, you go into almost where every day is an encounter with the supernatural. I've told you some of the stories of things that have happened to me in the past few months. And that's almost a daily occurrence right now. You know, for people who are coming into this, just be prepared because let me just add one thing here is when I started dealing with these energies, I really had to figure out a way how I was going to literally deal with them and work with them. And that's what eventually drove me back to studying Aikido again, because that's the only way I can find to, in a sense, focus these energies without letting them, in a sense, tear me from limb to limb. And I'm sure everyone else out there is going to have their own practices for working with these things. But yes, it is. It's incredible.
Yeah, it's a good point, Thomas. One really needs a practice of some kind. One might say an accessory practice of body work, body discipline, in order to handle the impact of planetary tantra, because the impact of planetary tantra is a power sharing dynamic. It's a dynamic coupling with the actual power of the earth. And if you read into the later books of Castaneda, you'll find that's exactly what he is saying. Don Juan and Don Janeiro speak eloquently of the fact that the source of the sorcerer's power is the earth, and that she is the great love of all sorcerers. And we take the boost of the earth's force to throw us into the supernatural. And this is actually what we're doing in planetary tantra. The mere contact with the material will bring you around to that experience. And then as you work with the material, the experience just intensifies. So this is really the follow-up of that magnificent body of work that Castaneda produced in his life. No matter what you may think of it, no matter whether you consider it invented or not, it doesn't really matter. The invention process is part of our dynamic endowment. It's part of our gift as Homo sapiens possessed of the power of imagination. In a sense, you could say that I am inventing planetary tantra, but you could equally say that planetary tantra is inventing me, you see? When you engage the power of imagination, which is the dreaming power of Gaia, you realize what it really is when you engage it. And this is what the path is. This is what the practice is. So it's wonderful that we can put this work and this planetary vision of Sophia in continuity with the shamanism of Carlos Castaneda. I like that very much.
Yes, indeed. And the remark you made a few minutes ago was very interesting, that Castaneda said that in a sense the crucifixion of Jesus was kind of a crucifixion of ourselves. And I've always thought it was strange that the Christians, people who proclaim themselves to be Christians, wear the cross on their, you know, on a necklace or whatever. And you think about it, that's the murder weapon, you know, that they're wearing on their body. That's never made sense to me.
Well, that's the perversion of the archons. As I point out in the last piece that I put on the site with an audio commentary, the consummation of the work of the archons, that is to say, the extreme deviance of our species from its proper course of evolution, manifests in behavior of extreme absurdity and extreme violence. And so you have the absurdity and the violence of a torture instrument, an instrument of murder, being taken as a symbol of divine love. I mean, you can't get much more absurd than that.
You really can't. It borders on being perverse.
It is perverse. It's And the people who wear that in the Vatican and who wear those enormous crosses that hang down around their bellies and parade around in red robes are, of course, it's well known. I'm not giving you any breaking news here. Among the greatest and sickest perverts on the planet.
Indeed, yeah, yeah. We don't have to go into the pedophilia and all that as well. I mean, it gets pretty ugly.
It does indeed. It gets very ugly. But what is pedophilia? It's an attack on the primal innocence of humanity. Mm-hmm. And the primal innocence of humanity is what Gaia counts on, and even Kali counts on it even more. You know, people talk about human divinity in some ways, as you know, Thomas, I'm very cautious of that kind of talk. We are divine. We are not gods, and that is an ego inflation game, as Jung himself pointed out, and he should know because he was a subject to that game. He knew what he was talking about because he had the god inflation problem himself. But when we speak about human divinity, there are, I believe, sane and valid ways to do so. One thing is to say that what is divine in us is nous, a dose of divine intelligence. What is divine in us is a faculty we have, not our identity, not our soul being, but a faculty we have. And secondly, we can say that innocence is our divinity. So an attack on innocence through pedophilia or any other abuse of children is an attack on human divinity. It was right to the core of the problem on this planet, right to the core of the spiritual war.
Indeed it does. You can't get much more ugly than that. So let's steer off from that a bit. We are now, John, in the shift of Bhagalamukhi. So I find this very fitting that this question that I've wanted to ask you since our very first planetary talk about 5 months ago, this is a question I've always wanted to ask, and it fits perfectly in with the theme, in a sense, or the flavor of this month. And that is when you start talking about memory and where you pose the question, what would happen if you were not recording exactly everything that is happening right now in your memory to be used at a future date for comparison purposes? And you specify two effects that would come out from that. Would you like to kind of shed some light on those for me?
Well, I'd like to hear what
Okay. The first effect would be, of course, that you would have no memory.
Right.
Because you would not be recording. So, of course, that memory would be gone.
Right.
In that sense, you go on to say that you wouldn't need a memory because you would be living in that present moment all the time.
Exactly. Well, you see, one of the principles of Planetary Tantra, a key principle, refers back to syntax from Castaneda's shamanism. He introduced the term the first attention and the second attention. I take up those terms and use them more or less in the same manner that he did, although I elaborate them a little more closely along the lines of the Gayan Tantras. So everything in the Gayan echo sorcery and Gayan shamanism must be related to the planetary animal mother, and everything must be understood in terms of her functions and how they interface with our functions. Normally, your memory is like a camcorder that's positioned on your shoulder, and it records your experiences. But it is possible for your memory to do otherwise. It is possible for that camcorder to be shut off as far as its recording function is concerned, and to be put in a shooting function or projecting function. When that occurs, you lose your memory and you go into real-time imagination, because the power that is actually operating behind memory is the dreaming power or imagination of Gaia. And so that is what happens when we do certain manipulations in shamanism, certain manipulations of consciousness and awareness to shift into the second attention. When you're in the second attention in a shamanic trance, you have no memory of that moment, but you don't need to remember it because you're in the eternal now when everything is present. So if you want to remember something that happened in that moment, you just go back to the now. You don't go back to that moment, that particular moment. You go back to the ground.
Right.
Right. So is that along the lines of what you were asking me?
Exactly it is. And I would like to get a little bit more on the how that, how would I say this? That in a sense, what you're doing is you're blocking one function or putting one function under a subdued situation. And with the second function, then you're bringing in really the creative wisdom of the Dakini. You're connecting the Dakini instruction, if I'm reading this correctly.
Well, yes. What you do is you put the function of memory on hold, you see? Mm-hmm. And that happens automatically when you go into a state of heightened awareness in the presence of nature. The reason why it happens is because the beauty of nature and the vital force of the goddess of the living planet that flows over you, that breaks over you like surf, temporarily shuts off the normal memory function. Memory can't function when you're in the presence of such awesome beauty and super vitality. And so when the memory function is temporarily shut off or put on hold, the power operating behind memory, which is the second attention, in Castaneda's terms, is still there. And that power, that function of your awareness, engages with the natural world directly. It engages with the beauty and intelligence and life force of the planet that is pouring over you. And in that engagement, you become part of the supernatural. Mm. You don't just see it. You do see it. You do see it. You have perceptions. You have depth perception. You see into the molecular scale of nature. You see the symbolic language of the fractal evolution of all forms. But you yourself, you see those things because you are in the supernatural. You are part of the supernatural. That's what happens when you enter the second attention, or the dreaming attention, as I call it.
Mm-hmm. Okay, yes, that's very clear. And
one of the things that Bhagalamukhi, called Idris, I like the term Idris because it's a simpler, more user-friendly term. Eventually, and before too long, all the Hindu tantric names of these Dakinis will fall away. Hmm. They will be shed naturally. That syntax will naturally molt and shed like the skin of a serpent. And a new, dynamic, living language for calling these frequencies will emerge automatically and naturally. So Idris is what I call the Dakini of the shift. And one of the things that you learn quite quickly when you enter into the process of following the lunar cycles is that each of these Dakinis and Mahavidyas who oversees a shift is highly specialized.
Mm-hmm.
Notice that.
Yes, yes. You can't help but notice it.
Yeah. It's as if you were in a classroom and there were a number of teachers that came into the classroom at different hours.
Mm-hmm.
And one teacher comes in and he or she knows everything about water, water vapor and clouds and waterfalls and rivers. And then that teacher gives you an hour lesson and goes off shift, and into the classroom comes another teacher who teaches you all about ribosomes and the interior ATP, adenosine triphosphate, and the interior chemicals of the body and the brain.
Mm-hmm.
They're incredibly specialized. And each time you go in the year around and you come around them again, they're even more specialized than before. It's a fantastic learning spiral. Anyway, Idris, or Bagalamuki, as he's traditionally called, specializes in this matter of the dual consciousness, the function of memory in its normal form, and the function that replaces memory when you go into heightened attention. So she teaches sort of the dance, the tango that takes place between memory and the dreaming attention or the second attention. And this is a fantastic experience. You actually get handled by her. She handles you like a tango dancer. She takes your consciousness and she takes your attention, and like a tango dancer, like holding you by the shoulders, you know how the male swings the female around in a tango?
Sure.
Those tango movements, how abrupt they are. Idris will take you and she'll hold you in your ordinary memory. And then she'll swing you around like a tango dancer into the dreaming attention. And then she'll swing you back into your ordinary memory. And this is how it feels when you are in these frequencies. Mm-hmm. You know, there's no abstraction I'm talking about here, nor is it really an intellectual process of downloading information. I have to emphasize, my friends, that what you get from the Dakinis of the Shakti cluster is not information. It's instruction. And instruction is empowered information.
Yeah.
The reason why this experience is so overpowering is that they cannot give you any information that you won't use.
Huh.
And so there's a tremendous urgency when you pick up the frequencies of these Dakinis, because you realize that the, quote, information, which is really not just dead information, is a dynamic engagement with the frequencies of that entity who is an expression in the 18-point console of Gaia herself.
Mm-hmm.
So it's a tremendous engagement with these frequencies, and it's a dance of attention and a dance of bliss and blissful knowing.
It certainly is. And Idris is, if you could say something that's so childish as what I'm about to say, she's my favorite so far. I mean, this month has been just blowing my socks off. And being in the surge right now, just before the full moon, it's like being at the pinnacle of clarity 1 minute, and then just totally lost in your own personal memories the next, and you're just popping in and out of that. It's an amazing, amazing ride or an amazing dance.
Yes, it is. And one does come to love these entities, to love these frequencies, whom we visualize as, you know, anthropomorphically as women. We do that simply because it is, we are humans, mm-hmm. and it is the way our syntax operates. And it is a way that we acclimatize ourselves to these supernatural forces. We know, in the sense of the Nahual, that they are unspeakable and unnameable forces. But in order to interact with them, we have to put on them some kind of a guise. And they assume the guise that suits us and that pleases us. So I'm sure she likes flirting with you, Donna, as much as you like her charm as well.
Absolutely. It's a lot of fun, that's for sure. All right, John, let's get into the main theme here. And I had another question, but I'm going to put that on the shelf for a while, because we really want to get into the events of March 19 as deeply as we can. Now, to go into this to begin with, there's a few definitions of some terms that some people may not be too familiar with. So I'm going to run these by you, and if you can just give me a brief description of each one of these, that will help facilitate the digesting of these later on. So the first word there is the apogee.
Right. Apogee is the point on the orbit of the moon when it is most distant from the Earth. At that point, you would see the moon, and it looks smaller than usual.
Okay, and then, of course, we have the perigee.
Perigee is the point on the orbit of the moon, which circulates around the Earth, when it is closest to the Earth. And that's when you have the supermoon phenomenon, and you notice, and it's very arresting, it'll stop you dead in your tracks when you look up and see the moon looks huge. Why? Because it is fortunately closer to the Earth than it is at other times.
And I'm still a bit unclear personally on the relation between the apogees, the perigees, and then the surges. Now, obviously, these have a connection with each other. Or do we need to get into the next word, which is the apsides?
Yeah, the apsides. A-P-S-I-D-E-S. Strange word. Apsides is the line. It's an astronomical term. These are all astronomical terms. The apsides is the line that connects the perigee of the moon, its closest point, to the apogee of the moon, its most distant point. That's called the line of the apsides.
Now, does that have a direct connection then into how you would calculate when surges are upon us?
Yeah, surges happen. Surges of the Shakti cluster, that is to say, massive eruptions of the life force and imagination of the planet itself, occur twice a month. But they do not occur at exactly regular periods like the new moons and full moons. Now, the reason for that is because the line of the apsides is very anomalous. It's extremely interesting in that respect because it's anomalous. Because the perigee, the near point, and the apogee, the far point of the moon, are not always located exactly opposite to each other. In fact, they rarely are. And so the line of the apsides is flexible. As a result, these two moments in each month, the moment when the moon is at perigee, supermoon, or when it is at apogee, appearing to be smaller, can occur, say, 10 days apart or as much as 16 or 17 days apart. So it's you have to be in real time to track these. And when these occur, there are surges across the entire electromagnetic field of the Earth relative to the dynamics that are always operating between the Earth and the Moon. So these are the monthly surges. The perigee surge, which we just underwent on the 12th of June, still in effect, and the apogee surge, which is coming up on the 24th of June.
Okay, yeah, I wanted to mention that just for reference sake, that we are now in the middle or the tail end of a perigee surge then.
Right.
Okay.
Now, in order to put this, some people are very uncomfortable with astronomy and astronomical terms, and they fall asleep and get a glazed look in their eyes at the mere mention of these words. Hey, I'm not asking much here, folks. You know, come on. If you can't learn five or six simple terms about the way the Earth operates and what's happening with the moon, then you're probably not worth bothering with, you know. But in order to make it easier for you, I would offer the nautical analogy. And I'm going to use the nautical analogy extensively now that we are in Gaius correction since March 19th. What are these surges in terms of the nautical analogy? Well, imagine that you're in a sailing boat. It's something like a huge clipper ship. It has square rigged sails, but it also has steam. It's a steam clipper. You know what that is?
I can imagine what it
is. They used to have steam clippers, okay? It was a boat that operated in part by steam, so it had propellers or paddle wheels propelled by steam, but it also was square rigged. And it was a clipper. Well, the great mother ship of Gaia, of the planet Earth, is like a steam clipper, and it's sailing on very, very high seas. And what Gaia does in steering the ship is that she tacks through these seas. Tacking, as you know, is a kind of a zigzag motion that a sailboat makes when it sails against the wind, right?
Sure.
Okay, she tacks. And when she tacks in one direction, which is port or left, naturally, if you're on the boat and you're tacking into high seas, you feel the whole boat lurch. It lurches as it tacks into the coming swell. And the lurch pulls it in a certain direction. Then it finds its way into that swell, and it floats, and it navigates across that swell, going, the swell is horizontally in the aligned to the direction the boat is going. So it goes up and down across the swell. Then when it tacks again to the right, which is the starboard in nautical terms, you feel again a lurch of the ship. There's a lurch as the prow of the ship reorients itself into the swell. This is what is actually happening with the planet. The planet is like a ship, and we can feel these lurches, and they are the surges that occur 2 times a month. Is that clear?
That is crystal clear. Wonderful. Wonderful. And there's one more term we need to get clarified here, and that's the barycenter.
Right. The barycenter is this common point of mass between the Earth and the Moon. Now, the Earth is a planetary body, a planet, a globular mass, 81 times more massive than the Moon. But the Earth and the Moon, which is another globular mass, a much lighter mass, are locked in a mutual dynamic. They're locked in a mutual, they're yoked together or structurally coupled, as the term goes in Gaia theory. And this coupling has a very peculiar form. Because the Earth is 81 times more massive than the Moon, the center of that coupling is displaced 81 times toward the Earth. So if you divide the distance between the Earth and the Moon 81 times into 81 sections, and you take one section of it, that is where the barycenter is located. So the barycenter, which is the shared center of mass of the Earth-Moon system, is actually within the Earth, and it's about 1,000 miles below the surface of the Earth. And as I mentioned before, and this is if this doesn't get your attention, nothing will. You've been taught that the Earth revolves around the Sun, haven't you?
Sure.
Well, that actually is not true. And teachers who teach you that in high school and in college should be severely chastised for their negligence. Because it's not the Earth that revolves around the Sun. It's the barycenter of the Earth Moon system that revolves around the Sun. Now, when you can picture that, you get a real picture of what is happening with this planet. It's not the center of the Earth does not make an elliptical orbit around the Sun, but the barycenter, which is off center from the center of the Earth, makes that elliptical orbital path around the Sun. And this mechanism of the barycenter is the whole key to the navigation of the mothership through the galactic arms, as well as the key to our participation in her journey.
So it's kind of like the fulcrum point of one single unit.
You have a seesaw that was 81 feet long, mm-hmm. and instead of having the fulcrum of the seesaw being in the middle, which would be about 40 feet, it's actually 1 foot from one end.
Exactly, and then that's moving around another body. That's moving around the Sun, so you can see that dynamic.
The Earth is moving around the Sun, and the Earth and the Moon are moving around the barycenter. This is the cosmic dance, my friends. This is what to pay attention to. This is this one astronomical detail that you need to picture and feel empathically and understand. This is not an abstraction I'm talking about here. You are caught in these motions right now. You are in the spiral dance of the barycenter right now. And you can become conscious of that fact and move with the Earth and the Moon in this dynamism. You can do that. And that is in great measure what planetary tantra is about in this post-correction phase.
Right. Again, the key to this, again, is imagination and intent.
Yes, imagination and intent, and also perception, you know. You can perceive what the barycenter is. You can perceive it by looking at the distance, looking at the way the Moon is small at sometimes and larger at other times. So we combine the three things. We combine imagination and intent with a direct perception of the phenomena of the physical world. That's how we get involved in her life and in her journey. It's not a dream. It's not a fantasy. It's a direct engagement.
And so this now leads us where I think we're ready to dive into actually what happened here on March 19.
Sure.
And the speed of the Barry Center then comes into play here very much.
That's right.
It normally moves around 720 miles per hour, which is
very close
to the speed of sound. Now, do you want to go ahead and take it from there?
Yeah, I want to point out that if you want to know what the Barry Center feels like, you can know that. What you do is you observe the moon in the sky. Let's take the most simple example. When the moon is full or near full, at a certain time in the evening, you'll see the moon come up in the east, and it'll move across the horizon, and at a certain point, it'll be at the meridian. That is the highest place over where you are on the Earth. So that's when you stand and you look up, and it is at the highest point, like the top of an arch. At that point, the moon is physically on the meridian, and the Barry Center is always exactly underneath the moon. It's always underneath the moon. So when you stand there looking up at the moon, you can realize that about 1,000 miles beneath your feet is the Barry Center. Now, the Barry Center moves with the moon, and so it makes a complete circuit around the Earth once every 24 hours. And it does so, you might imagine it like a locomotive, tunneling through the Earth 1,000 miles below the surface. And this locomotive, the speed of this locomotive, the speed of the Barry Center can be calculated quite easily. A high school astronomy student could do this. And it comes up to around 720 miles an hour. Now that is very, very close to 768 miles an hour, is the speed of sound. And everyone knows what happens when you exceed the speed of sound, right?
Yes, you get a sonic boom.
That's right. You get the sonic boom. And so, because of the fantastic fluidity of the Earth-Moon-Sun dynamic, the Earth-Moon-Sun dance, which is part of the Gaian three-world system, and because of the anomalies in this system, and the way that you can't plot it out, the way that you can't nail it down with male mind formulas, you can't predict it. You know, it's totally feminine. It's totally fickle and capricious. You have to live with it in real time to know what it's doing, you know? Because of all those things, the velocity of the very center varies in unpredictable ways. So this locomotive, if you want to imagine it as such, is tunneling in a circular path through the interior of the Earth. And every 24 hours, it completely goes around the Earth. But its velocity varies. And what happened, remarkably, I believe for the first time, but not for the last time, on March 19th, 2011, is that the velocity of the Barry Center exceeded the speed of sound. It sent out a sonic boom from the interior of the Earth, which was detected by people at that time.
Yes, well, probably the most shocking report, or the one that people might be familiar with or have a memory of, was the reports coming out of Florida, I believe it was, where people were hearing this incredible rumbling sound that... there are various reports, people describing it as machinery, people were describing it as, like we just said, sonic booms, thunder and lightning, but all coming from, you know, below the surface of the Earth. And this went on for quite some time.
It went on for like 20 minutes.
Yeah,
And number of YouTube clips of people are standing there on the lawns or their houses or looking out the kitchen window with their jaws hanging down. And calling the local police and calling the airport. And this is a completely inexplicable event. And the second remarkable thing that happened was this sound that was detected in Tibet coming from the interior of this cave, which is also on several YouTube clips. One of them is 20 minutes long, and it records the sound. You can sit there and listen to it. Now, granted, this is just two small examples from a very large planet, but I would venture to say that for every event of such a nature that ends up being announced in a YouTube clip, there could be 100 or 1,000 more instances of that event.
Absolutely. So, people would be kind of reluctant, perhaps, to report it.
People have capacity to upload clips on YouTube. I mean, come on, face it, you know. But what I'm saying is, it may seem like very small corroboration of what I'm saying, but I am certain that at that time there were other phenomena of this nature, and that people observed and heard remarkable sounds around the time just after the Fukushima event, remarkable sounds that could not be explained. And I interpret these as being a result of the barycenter of the Earth exceeding 768 miles per hour and releasing a sonic boom from the interior of the Earth. Now, that sonic boom was just a sonic boom, so it's only traveling at 728 miles an hour, and it would take it a very, very, very long time to reach the center of the galaxy, which is 25,000 light years away. But it's not that sonic boom that is the signal Gaia sent to the center of the galaxy. The sonic boom is merely her way of alerting the Earth and the inhabitants of the Earth that she has sent a signal, that she has re-established two-way communication with the other pleromic eons in the galactic center. And this is the beginning of her process of correction that was predicted in Gnostic writings.
Okay, now that's where it's getting really interesting. So that's, in a sense, it's a signal being sent to the crew, to the people that are working together with her in this correction.
Right. The signal that comes from the Earth itself, the roar or rolling sound from the center of the Earth, is to us, the crew. You know how on a big ocean liner, when the captain wants the crew to come to the main deck, that is the wheelhouse, there's a blast of a horn. Because the crew of officers who assist the captain in navigating the ship can be at various places on the ship at any moment, okay? They can be in their quarters, they can be dining, or they can be attending to some matters. Some of them might be in the engine room discussing something with the engineers. There's a moment when the captain in the wheelhouse wants to assemble all the crew for an important discussion of navigation. And so a bullhorn, or a very loud horn, blares over the vessel. This is an experience that many people have had who have been sailing on these ocean liners. And that is exactly the analogy for what Gaia did. She sent out this signal to the crew to assemble. At the same time, in her own way, according to her own methods and powers, which are yet to be understood, she established a signal contact with the aeons of the galactic center, which is to her the home port from which she began her journey in the first place. And if that isn't absolutely beautiful, I don't know what.
Absolutely. If you can't get excited about that, then you might just roll over and go back to sleep. Huh?
Okay. You might as well go watch television. You know, I think that is just so beautiful.
Oh, yeah. Absolutely. Now, this really gets into the really, in a sense, the esoteric part of this. It's the stuff that might not, people would have really no frame of reference to kind of compare it with. So we kind of need to explain things very carefully here. Let's see. Do you want to talk about how Channel 17 plays into this as a signal carrier, in a sense?
I think in the second series of talks, mm-hmm. subjects like that may come up on the agenda. What I would like to do now is address the concern you just stated.
Okay.
I also would like to make this matter, which to me is the most wonderful event I've ever experienced in my life in terms of following the cosmic process, I'd like to make this matter as accessible as possible and to describe it in a user-friendly way. So I'm going to consistently use the nautical analogy. And I'm going to talk about the mothership is the planet Earth, which is the body of a divine being, Sophia. She is both the body of the Earth and she is the indwelling consciousness of the Earth. So she is both the ship and the captain of the ship. In this case, the ship and the captain of the ship are the same. Okay?
Got it.
The navigational team now assembles. And what happens at that point? Well, a fantastic opportunity arises. That is the opportunity for those who want to be in the navigational crew, that is to say, who don't just want to be passengers on the ship, but who want to be involved with the captain, who want to know where it's going and why, who want to know what ports of call it's going to make, assemble on the deck. And I will provide in the coming months now the means and the tools to follow this navigational process. One of the analogies that I'm introducing is that of the captain's log. You know, mm-hmm. Now, people would be familiar with this maybe from Star Trek, you know. As you remember, I think, I wasn't a Star Trek fan, but I don't think there's anybody who hasn't seen at least one episode of Star Trek. And I believe they often start with this announcement, you know, Starship Enterprise, Captain's Log. Mm-hmm.
Stardate, such and such, yes.
Yeah. Stardate, da-da-da-da-da. Well, that's exactly how we're going to proceed. Spaceship, Earth, Mothership, Captain's Log. What is the Captain's Log? The Captain's Log is the way that Gaia herself, the living intelligence of this planet, will plot her own course from this point on. And I'm here to tell you that we can look over her shoulder as she is writing her log and know exactly what she is plotting at the moment she plots it. Now, wrap your imagination around that.
It is. It's an amazing concept to take on board, isn't it?
It is. It's an amazing concept to take on board. This is where it begins, and it's not something, it's not metaphysics, folks. I often delight in pointing out this fact. There is no metaphysics in planetary contact. Okay? There's no physics. There is astronomical physics. There is bioenergetic physics, sexual physics, psychosomatic physics, genetic physics. There are many kinds of physics, and physics is faith, by the way. This is a teaching of Vidra. Physics is fate. So the physics you choose will determine your fate. You want to choose quantum physics? It'll determine your fate. You want to choose relativity theory? It'll determine your fate as a human being. You want to choose electric universe theory? That would be an interesting fate. So we're talking here about a kind of physics, astrophysics, geophysics, but it's not metaphysics. It's something that we're going to prove and demonstrate at each step along the way. That is what unfolds now. That's the fantastic opportunity we have as we enter into the correction of the planetary mother, animal mother. As we enter into her correction, we have this opportunity to participate in this and to test these notions that I'm proposing, to test them in real time.
Yes, you were saying before we actually started recording that what is going to take place in these talks here on out is kind of the post-correction, and we're going to be going into things in a bit of a different manner than we have up to this point. Would you like to go a little bit into the 4 points of galactic orientation, or do you think that's getting a bit too heavy for this talk tonight?
Well, just give a glimpse of it right now. And we will detail it at a future time when it's appropriate.
Okay.
In order to practice planetary contact, and in order to join with Gaia on her journey through the universe, you need to picture the setting of her journey. Everyone can do this, and everyone who who claims to be spiritual ought to do this. Otherwise, I don't personally buy your ass at all. You ought to know that the solar system is like a fleet of ships, and it is sailing on a great broad river, which is the third spiral arm of a lenticular spiral galaxy, which is one of countless billions of galaxies floating in infinite space. So the picture that you need to form in your imagination to know where we're at is the picture of a lenticular spiral galaxy. That is a carousel or pinwheel galaxy. It has a central core of pure molten plasmic luminosity. At this core, in this core, which is 25,000 light years from where the solar system is moving, there are no planets, and there are no animals, and there are no angels or demons. There are only the aeons, which are torrential serpents of light. So that's what's at the core of the galaxy. And then unfurling from that core in a carousel fashion are the four or five spiral arms, which are like great rivers, great curving rivers that swirl around the central core. In these spiral arms are stars and many, many planetary systems. In our galaxy alone, and the Sophia myth is a story about our galaxy alone. In our galaxy alone, it's estimated that there are over 200 billion stars in the river of stars circulating around the core. Many of these 200 billion stars have planetary systems, and many of the planets are Earth-like. And on many of those systems, other strains of the human species are living. But what is special about our story is that it is our story. It's about the special conditions and the unique and, in certain respects, anomalous factors that have brought about the world as we know it today. The Sophia myth tells us how humanity originated in the galactic center and how Sophia herself morphed into the setting where humanity would evolve. One strain, or just one strain of humanity. Now, I want to point something out, by the way. I want to correct something that I hear frequently from the David Icke people and others who are indulging in various planetary fantasias, as I would call them. Planetary fantasia, by that I mean they're talking about the planet and planetary evolution and planetary events, but they're not grounding it in a knowledge of the planet, and they're not grounding it in interactivity with Gaia. So it is a planetary fantasia. We avoid fantasias in planetary tantra. The real pleasures of this practice exceed any possible fantasia. And one of the errors that comes up with people enmeshed in these fantasias is that they're often talking about this 12-strand DNA. I don't know if you've heard
that. Yes, you hear that pop up quite often. Yeah.
More and more frequently, you're going to hear it. Now, this is a complete fantasia. First of all, folks, there is no verification that we were ever created with a 12-strand DNA and that we're supposed to be operating with 12 strands instead of two. This is like New Age fantasia.
You hear that that's supposed to kick in then with the 2012 event and all that.
We also hear that that indigo children are already coming in and they have their 12 strands up. And this is all make-believe and fairy in your eyes, okay?
Sure.
But there is, from the Gnostic point of view, a certain germ of truth behind that fantasia. Now, I'd like to tell you what that germ of truth is. In my understanding, as a telestis and seer of the cosmos, it's my understanding that the master template of the human species, called the genome, and called the Anthropos by the Gnostics, is deposited in a molecular cloud in the Orion Nebula. And that cloud is like the mycelium, moist mycelium base from which strands or spores of this genome propagates in the galactic limbs. You get that picture?
Mm-hmm.
Okay. It's a mycelium, it's a moist mycelium environment, the Orion Nebula. And it's a living environment. And from that Orion Nebula, the genome puts out strands or filaments, which then attach themselves to planetary worlds so that various strains of the human experiment can unfold in these worlds. Now, I put it to you that that master template in the Orion Nebula is a 12-strand genomic model.
Hmm.
But that when the filaments go out from the master genome, from the matrix, they do not necessarily carry all 12 strands, and they don't need to. Now, there may be on another planet, planetary system, an Earth-like system, another strain of the human species that's operating on 3 strands or 6 or even 1. That is the versatility and the magnificent diversity of the panspermic emanation of the master genome.
So let me clarify that for my own understanding here. So in a sense, the seeds, the genome is spread through panspermia, through being carried by comets, through asteroids.
Right, or just floating propagules and filaments which float through space.
And some of those could then be broken off into 1 strand or 8 strands or on and on.
Right, the dissemination of those filaments is extremely diverse. Now, let's face the facts, folks, and not get into New Age fantasies here. We are one strain of countless strains of humanity evolving in this galaxy, and we happen to be a strain on the planet Earth that incorporates 2 filaments out of the 12-filament genome. Period. Okay?
Mm-hmm.
To say that we are supposed to have 12 and the archons and reptilians ripped out our other 10 and all this is a bunch of bogus nonsense.
Sure.
Gets in the way of a clear picture that we can verify. You know? Let's just look at the facts, folks. We have 2 strands, and we can do everything you can imagine with 2 strands, believe me. Don't go around thinking that you need 12 strands in order to perform magic and be a wizard of the cosmos, because you don't, okay? So my correction of that fantasia would be that we have 2 strands because we are a particular 2-stranded variation of the 12-strand genomic master template.
So 2 strands is sufficient for us, and we don't have to consider ourselves to be, in a sense, stranded without the other 10 or...
Yeah. We are not stranded. We are not handicapped. It's absolutely ridiculous. And it gives a phantom power to these archonic reptilian parasites and fakers and hoaxers. You know, it contributes to their hoax upon us to make the claim that they shut down or withdrew or blocked off 10 of our strands. It just contributes to their hoax to say things like that.
Yeah, it sure does. That's a very interesting way to look at that, because it's debilitating us in a sense, right, from the outset. It's a psychic ploy, in a sense, to cut off our own abilities.
The point is that we are using about 5%, that only 5% of our genomic potential goes into coding the actual biological genome. We know that now. So, challenge is not to indulge in some fantasy of rewiring ourselves as a 12-stranded genomic entity. That's not the challenge. The challenge is to activate consciously the other 95% of the genome. And if that doesn't keep you busy, and if that's not a challenge, well, I'm sorry. Okay?
Yeah, I like that. That's good. Very nice, John.
Talk a lot about this subject in the post-correction talks, because one of the main themes of post-correction is epigenesis or mutation.
Mm-hmm.
These mutations already began to occur in an alarming and radical fashion even before correction occurred. And they're happening now in a massive way. In fact, the whole threat of radiation, of mutations of the human genes from radiation of Fukushima is in a way a kind of a whitewash and a hoax. That's not really what's happening. There could be a higher quantity of radioactive radiation in the Earth's atmosphere. I wouldn't doubt it. But that's not what's really happening. Behind that, Gaia herself is mutating the human species and other species genetically in accord with the direction she takes in her correction. We are undergoing a rapid and massive epigenetic rewiring of our entire species through the so-called reverse transcriptase. Reverse transcriptase is an enzyme that works in the genetic process that allows RNA to rewrite DNA. And baby, that's not all it does. People have discovered that that's what it does, and the scientists who discovered that got the Nobel Prize. No big deal. That's nothing compared to what it actually does. So the rescripting of our whole DNA through the RNA is a great, great secret of Gaia's correction and something we are now going to be seeing unfold in many, many ways. Many, many remarkable, inexplicable things are going to be happening and are happening very, very fast as correction proceeds.
Man, that is so interesting. And you know, John, in a couple of days, I'm going to be interviewing Robert Felix, who talks a lot about this, about the sudden changes in evolution, how it's not a slow, steady progression, but one that goes very quickly, and that we are right in the prime time right now for that to take place again.
Robert Felix is like the Dr. Spock of the navigation team.
I'll tell him that.
Robert Felix is such a genius and is so warm and accessible in what he says. He's an outsider like me. He's not a scientist. You know, Thomas Kuhn wrote The Structure of Scientific Revolutions in the 1960s, and he pointed out that the great breakthroughs in every field of science, whether it be astronomy, biology, or whatever, always come from outsiders and marginal people like Robert Felix and myself. So I really welcome him, and what he is saying is so resonant and so lucidly aligned to Gaia's correction that I would put him among the first people who are intuitively picking up on this fantastic event. I would put him right at the top of the list.
That's wonderful. I'll relay that to him. I think he'll be tickled pink with that. Like you said, he's done all this on his own, just as you have done. It's all been funded, you know, on his own, and it's been independent research, and he's brought through incredible fruits of understanding, just as you have done.
You can only do it if you're on your own, because if you get an education, you have been mind-programmed into a set of paradigms that is like being locked in a series of paper bags, and you fight your way out of one, and you're in another paper bag. And that's why the breakthroughs always come from us, you know, country boys from Maine, those who refuse to be educated and refuse to buy the prevailing paradigms. And that's how it shall ever be. So listen, Thomas, just want to point out we're at 1:04. And if we want to continue, say, for a little longer, I would have to switch to the next band because this only goes to 1:06 on GarageBand.
Right, right. Well, let's just go ahead and take one more minute and wrap things up, and we can pick this up in a few days.
So this would be then the second part of this in a few days.
Exactly. Let's do that.
Then we could formally into Series 2 of the Planetary Council Talks.
That sounds like the best way to go.
Okay. All right.
Okay, let's go ahead and sign it off for today, John, and I thank you again. It's wonderful to finally be back in contact with you after a couple weeks there. And let's do this more on a periodic basis from here on out.
We'll see if we can. We'll see if we can, Thomas. I'd like that. Thank you very much.
And I'll talk to you later.
Yeah, bye now.